Hey, welcome back to the show. Today's guest is Dan Abrahams, sports psychologist and host of the Sport Psych Show. Expect to learn the importance of understanding the human in high performance, Dan's biopsychosocial model, the importance of coaches buying into psychology, Dan's opinion on what makes an effective practitioner, and much more. Hey, do you mind doing me the biggest favor? And that is hitting the follow or subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening to this show on. It is the cheapest and easiest way in which you can support the show. By doing that, it raises the profile, it allows us to get more guests on, and helps create better, interesting conversations for you guys to listen to. So your support is super valuable, and I thank you so much for doing that. This episode is brought to you by Mindstrong Sport. As an athlete myself, I wished I had something to help me get into meditation and also practice mental skills. As a coach, I wanted to give something to athletes to work on these skills in their own time. And that's where Mindstrong Sport comes in. Using specially designed meditations, insights and skills, blending mindfulness, meditation, performance psychology that you can practice in your own time. The goal of Mindstrong Sport is to not only make a calmer, confident and more focused mind on the field, but improve the quality of the mind off it as well. So whether you're an athlete and you want to use it for yourself, whether you're a coach that could use it also, or even offer it as a tool to those that you work with in your teams, Mindstrong Sport is designed to make your mind your greatest skill. As a listener of the show, you get 20% off all subscriptions by using the code RAISINGYOURGAME at checkout via the special link in the description of this episode. That's 20% off all subscriptions by using the code Raising Your Game at checkout via the link in the description of this episode. But on to today's episode with Dan Abrahams. Enjoy. Dan, it's great to have you back, mate, and I'm glad we've managed to squeeze some time in.
Lewis, it's been some time since we've spoken. It's awesome to be talking with you again. Thank you so much for giving up some of your time to have a chat.
Oh, mate, what have you been up to? What's of interest for you at the moment? What's on the plate of Dan Abrahams?
What's on the plate? Just fish and chips, mate. That's all. it's been busy. Which is a good thing, as you know, when you're a consultant. This year has been a mix of things, really. I mean, my podcast, The Sport Psych Show, is going strong, and so that's a part of it. And but I've got a wonderful editor in my wife, who makes me sound about 10 IQ points higher than I actually am. So that's a shared responsibility there. So that takes up a little bit of time, not a huge amount, but that's joyous to do in terms of getting academics on and talking about the academic side of sports psychology and sports coaching and skill acquisition. From a consulting perspective, I've been heavily involved in motorsport this year. I've been a consultant psychologist at Aston Martin Formula One. I've continued to work at a Dutch football club called Feyenoord. They won the Eredivisie back in May. I was from a tiny part of that process, but still good fun to be involved with them. I've worked heavily in esports as well, which is an interesting world that I've started to learn about last couple of years, or last year and a half, I should say. Those have been my main three consultancy gigs, and then just a wide population of athletes from all kinds of sports, from tennis and golf you name it, and I've probably dabbled in it this year. So all the fun of the fair, I'd say.
Mate, talk to me about the F1 circuit at the moment. What's the feel in that world? It's such a unique world, isn't it? Yeah. What's the temperature on the track, essentially?
It's hot. I think it's a really interesting world, and I'm absolutely not an expert. I've been blessed to work with a great company this year, Aston Martin, and I'll be respectful in terms of confidentiality, but You know, it's amazing to get involved with people who are masters of their craft, in terms of, you know, the engineering side of things. I predominantly worked with the pit crew at Aston Martin, and, you know, several key stakeholders behind the scenes. And it's great to work with a company who are striving to improve and be the best that they can be. You know, they've risen up the standings this season. I mean, it's not all been an upward trajectory. There's been some last few months, when we were speaking, a race just gone by, they finished third and fifth with Fernando and Lance. But behind the scenes, you know, they've built a new factory, and it's, you know, they would say themselves they're trying to get the human part right as well as the sort of the mechanical and the engineering part. And one can debate this for hours, I'm sure, but I think the human part is the complex part and the difficult part. Not to suggest that the mechanical and the engineering part aren't difficult, they are, but the human side is tough. The communication, top down, bottom up, you know, the role clarity, the teamwork, all those kind of things are thrown into the mix. So it's an area I think Formula One continues to be curious about and continues to strive to improve upon, given that its key players, its key stakeholders are probably, to use an incorrect but sort of cliched way of looking at the brain, tend to be quite left-brained, you know, in terms of, you know, looking at things through data and numbers and stuff like that. And I understand it's not a fully accurate representation of how the brain works, but they might lean towards that side of things more so than the people side of things. But it's starting to become alive with the possibility, Formula One, of introducing people like myself and yourself into the mix. So yeah, it's an interesting world.
Do you think that just lends, because of the natural, the state of that sport? It is so numbers based. I mean, I'm a cricketer. Like, we are numbers and stats based, for right? So, but that is quite literally eking out every millisecond from, the technicians to the engineers to the tactics, like everything, and the pit stops, and just it has to lend itself to it, because eyes outside of the sport are on that, aren't they? That's when you're seeing a car and moving that pace, and a machine just flying around, it's hard to think that there's a human being inside there, or a human being in the pit stop that's got all of their intricacies, idiosyncratic parts of their life that are just, you could easily move that to one side.
Yeah, and I think it's well said, and I think it's to me, it's sense making. You know, it's making sense of the links, the relationship, you know, between the data and the human side of things. You know, we overtly see the data, or we overtly work on, you know, the mechanics of the car, and the engineers overtly work on the systems that underpin the car. But what's not overtly seen, even for the people inside the organization, what's not necessarily obvious is, you know, are the small conversations that go on, the relationships that are established, the relationships that aren't established, you know, the communication that doesn't go on, the cohesion that's there, and the cohesion that isn't there, and so on and so forth. So, and all of those things can be challenging to detect. And so subsequently, you know, I would always argue having people from the outs come from the outside and maybe throw some ideas, some frameworks and models, you know, some checks and challenges around the human side of things, and potentially create some, you know, macro structures from top down, that impact the micro systems within, and even from bottom up, you know, discussing the microsystems, the small relationships, the small conversations, as I mentioned before. You know, these things are absolutely imperative and bear greatly on the data. However, I admit it takes some trust that they do bear greatly on the data, because you can't necessarily see these things happen. So, you know, it takes trust, it takes time, for the kind of things that you work on to bed in, and sometimes it's very, very difficult to measure those things.
I was going to say, how do you navigate that almost measuring the somewhat immeasurable?
Look, I think it's a keen mix of you do and you don't. I you know, for me, how I would go about it, for example, is I might create a framework, co-create a framework with the people who have engaged me. So let's say Aston Martin have engaged me, and I might co-create a series of values or action-based words that we're going to identify ourselves around, and that's going to guide our behaviors, and it's going to guide our observations around behaviors that we don't necessarily want, or are inefficient or ineffective, or help us to understand our people and how they like to go about things. So we're going to create these things that actually might lend themselves to some subjective measurement. You know, so we could take this word confidence, for example. You know, we want to act with confidence. Confidence is an important value for us. Let's just imagine that. Well, what does that mean to our pit crew? To be confident, to engage confidently. And we can talk about all the things, all the behaviors we might engage in that we, you know, in a confident manner. Confident conversations, you know, even having confidence around contestation, for example, to debate things rigorously, to strive to find agreement where there wasn't agreement before, to give people the facility and the comfortableness to disagree. So we might take one word and we might think of all the behaviors that word underpins. And then along that journey, we can have conversations around the measurement there, you know, how we're doing that. And it's not the same kind of data as this is our lap time and this is the speed in which the car can go. And we're going to, you know, those kind of things. But it's the softer side of things that underpin our capacity to have the best possible data, raw data around the car. So let me come back to my point of we can and we can't. We can, in the sense that I've mentioned, the subjective notion of assessing these subjective qualities and striving to make them as objective as we possibly can. But you're saying, well, if we take a word like confidence as a value or an action word, let's think of all the behaviors related to that. These are the kind of behaviors that we're going to promote across the organization or across, let's say, a specific population or group, such as the pit crew. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to assess how we're going in formal and formal settings. From there, I would argue that we can't do much more. That we do as an organization have to accept that is as far as we can take measurement of this kind of thing. I think there has to be an acceptance of that.
Yeah, I remember author James Kerr of Legacy, who's been on the show as well. Yeah. We spoke around culture. It's a huge part of his book Legacy, obviously.
Of course.
And it was the conversations at water cooler, those being sort of the measurements that you might see of whether a culture's going wrong. What are the small little actions that are taken that you've chosen? Like you've agreed upon that when our culture, when our team is living up to those values, that they, when we're acting those out in the small, nuanced ways, that's when we're going all right. And you're right, it doesn't have to be, well, have you seen Jeff at the water cooler? Have you seen them talking much? Have you seen the people engaging, having conversations like this? I think there's no need for a questionnaire on that. There's no need for a measure. There's just pure, what is everyone seeing? How's everyone doing? And that, like you mentioned about cohesion, that's a byproduct, then just becomes that byproduct. It's not something that you've actively trying to force and create. You've just done it through those actions and behaviors. I'm interested when you go into a team or the teams that you work with. So Aaron Walsh, you've had him on the podcast or your podcast as well.
Yeah.
And he did a paper, I don't know if you saw it, around people willing to take on mental skills, essentially, coaches. When you've found perhaps resistance to the work, how have you gone around that resistance? And because I think the times are changing. We can't deny times are changing. There is far more awareness around psychology, mindset, mental skills. Netflix, I feel, are bringing out documentary series after documentary series. They're all psychology documentaries. They just so happen to have a sport involved in them. And yeah. I think there's more conversation going on around that. But there are people who will maybe not understand it because it's maybe not come from their era. They haven't engaged with it. And so they think it's this thing that they need to be available to people. But I have met and seen people with resistance. They almost look at you going, what is this? What does this all mean? How have you navigated that space if you've ever experienced it?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think it's a really tough one to answer because in my sort of catalogue of experiences, each experience tends to expose a different scepticism or even cynicism or pushback, if you like. And so each case tends to be individual. It tends to be one big challenge or a set of challenges. What I would say is, I think if I was to answer it truthfully, I would say there's definitely been some moments in my career, sometimes some gigs or positions where I haven't necessarily dealt with it very well. That, you know, I've left a position or haven't attained a position or only sort of consulted from a distance and not closer in, because perhaps the personal people pushing back have, I hesitate to say the word won, but they've been victorious in their skepticism, nothing further has taken place. I think the best way I can answer your question is to actually say that what I try to do now is listen and meet people where they're at as best as I can. I've got my frameworks, and I think that is important for a practitioner. I don't think this is a buffet. You know, I don't think it's just an all-you-can-eat buffet whereby you can have absolutely anything, because whilst I try to deal with my own cognitive biases, I'm still going to have my lens of the world and how I feel I can best contribute to an organization, a club, a team. And so I will come in and I will listen. And where I hear the opportunity, I will suggest, well, here are my frameworks. As if you want me to dive into some granular detail, for example, I tend to show potential clients my biopsychosocial model, whereby if people listening in can use their imagination here, visualization, if you think about the technical, tactical, and physical components, I would be inclined to put something up on your PowerPoint and say, look, technical, tactical, physical is, if we're talking sport here, this exists and it exists everywhere in sport. So these are happening every single second. But then I'll put a box up with arrows to those technical, tactical, physical, saying the biopsychosocial component, the person, the body-mind-world. Because I think as sports psychologists, we need to be more robust than just psychology. We need to say body, mind, world, bio, psycho, social.
Yeah, that's a great point, especially from an athlete's point of view, because they resonate with the physical a lot.
And there's a constant link there. And I'm saying biopsychosocial is always happening. Mm. And it's always mediating technical, tactical, and physical. Anyway, look, there's a bit more to the model, but... No, I might find an opportunity as I listen and we talk and listen to where they're at, what they want, and then I will dive in. And more often than not, Lewis, it's okay. My biopsychosocial, make a bit of a joke, our biopsychosocial, not very catchy, is it? Difficult to sell, but then break it down to body, mind, world, and then we just talk about let's think about the things you've told me already. Oh, well, yes, you know, sometimes your players from as basic, sometimes your players switch off. You know, a head coach might say that to me. An organization might say, you know, a club might say, we want our organization to really treat our players in as humanely as possible, fashion as possible. Do you want a psychologically informed environment? Okay, well, biopsychosocial, and then I'll break it down further, and then I'll dive into the bio, the psychologically informed environment. So I'm just listening and trying to meet people where they're at. And I feel that's a kind of a pre-mortem, if you like. That pre-mortem potentially heads off the problem, the challenge that you speak about. If you do find yourself challenged, I mean, I would say I can think of something recently that happened in a gig of my way. I'm kind of thinking, yeah, I'm being kept a little bit at arm's length here, you know, in what I can potentially offer. And I think sometimes there is. I think sometimes you have to accept it. You know, maybe you're not the right fit for the organization, or maybe they want to go off in a different direction. You know, whilst I might say that biopsychosocial is always happening, you know, there can be great people in the organization who do great biopsychosocial stuff themselves. You know, great medical departments who, through their treatment of players from the sports sciences and the SCLACs and the strength and conditioning coaches, do great job, great work in psychology, and you know, they don't want to put their resources into me. So you do have to be accepting of quite a complex dynamic landscape. So okay, I'm going to take a step back and I'll be patient, or I'll have to take a step away. That's fine as well. I think acceptance is quite important. But one more thing to say here is, once you've listened, once you've introduced, once you've met, you're meeting them where they're at, then I think it's about putting effective frameworks in place where you're working ideally systemically, which is the mesostructure level. If you think of micro system, mesosystem, and macro structure is top down. That's what does this club or organization want? What does it stand for? What are its overarching values? You know, through to that, what style of play does this club want? You know, and maybe you might point at Manchester United at the moment. Maybe you don't quite have their macro structures in place. So the confusion from top down reigns. Then you've got the meso system underneath that, which is more kind of like the team, the coaching staff and the team. What messages, what communication, you know, what values are they into? How are they going about things on a day-to-day basis in training and so on and so forth? What types of training sessions do they do? And then you've got the micro system, which is the one-to-ones, the one-to-small groups, the small coaching unit. So I'm very much, where can I look to, where do you want me to impact? Where can we, let's negotiate here. Where can I best impact here? So when I got involved with England Rugby, for example, and it's been a few years, so I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying, Eddie Jones said to me, I want you predominantly working with and through coaches. Now, I might quibble about that, but that's a direct instruction from the head coach. So I could sit there and say, well, I think you're wrong. And if I can convince him he's wrong, I'm sure he would change his mind. But okay, fine, you won't be working with, he wants to be working at the mesosystem level. Fine, no problem. Let's do that. Let's find a way. And then over time, we might find a way to get into the microsystem. So I'm trying to find, look, let me condense this so we can make sense. Number one, I'm going to listen. We're going to have a conversation. We're going to try to make sense of the situation. Then we're going to start to negotiate to meet people where they're at, what they potentially need. So I'm going to introduce them to a few things. And then we're going to find whereabouts in the organization, you know, top, middle, bottom, combination. Where am I going to find my first steps here with the right frameworks, with the right people, and then drive from there? That's a pre-mortem. That gets things right from the beginning, and then you're trying to do the right things along the way. But that navigation is tough there and there onwards. It really is challenging, especially as coming back to what you were saying before, in a world that is starting to accept us, starting to see, has always seen the value of psychology, but has always perhaps felt that coaches do psychology alone, and is starting to now open up. It's still a tough navigation.
How important do you think it is for coaches in that meso structure to have engaged in the work themselves. And especially with now, and many coaches are past players, have potentially been in the game that have played it. It's not everyone, but you say it's a high percentage. How important do you think it is for coaches to have engaged with psychological training, mental skills, however way you want to frame it?
Engaged historically in it.
Yeah, so they've I would even say how much they're perhaps engaging with it whilst they're coaching.
Yeah. Look, I the two ways I'll answer that would be it always helps if a coach has had a positive experience working with it, or any experience, but because even a negative experience, you can have a conversation about the experience that they've had and potentially influence and change their mind. You know, should that negative experience have led them to be slightly skeptical about its use? A positive experience really, really helps, because usually then you've got an open door. I think the other thing I want to say is we are starting to train, and again, understanding that I still want to meet people where they're at, I would still put to all coaches out there, you are starting to tread into a world now where if you are not going to engage in this stuff in as efficacious a manner as possible, that is going to limit your ability to coach, especially head coaches who have to see the helicopter viewpoint. And the reality is these days is whether it's these organizations that are becoming bigger and bigger and more bloated, rightly or wrongly, with huge amounts of staff, or even if we come down to organizations with lesser staff, lesser resources, we're going to utilize those resources, bring in the sports psych. If you're just going to simply say, well, I'm going to siphon off this sports psych over there, they're in that office, or they're over there by the side of the pitch, you're just not going to do it as effectively as than if two things. You're giving the sports psychologist more opportunity to work with players and teams, and you're willing to be open for that psychologist to work with and through you as well. You need to be willing. More and more now, I think they need to be willing to listen and to work on these things. And therein lies a problem, because you're asking people to cut away at their autonomy. And that's what head coaches love, their autonomy. By autonomy, I'm being polite in by saying it's my way or the highway. You know, yeah. I'm in charge. This is what I'm doing. And really the underpinning of, you know, when I've sat in rooms and not being listened to or haven't felt I've been listened to, you just think this person, or perhaps more accurately, not given assigned things to do within the organization that involve coaching and coaches, then I just think it's low trust from the head coach. It's a lack of knowledge. It's a lack of knowledge and a lack of ability to manage me, to manage with me, to work with me, to engage, to negotiate, to use me effectively. I think the future lies with head coaches, managers, head coaches who have the capacity to work with auxiliary staff in the most effective and efficacious manner, to understand that they don't know everything, to understand that actually to distribute power more and distribute decisions more. I do think that I honestly believe, if I think of football, which is probably where I work most, I think if you look at right now, Pep and De Zerbi at Brighton, and maybe Klopp at Liverpool, and others, of course, that you are looking at very gifted, Serena Wieg, Emma Hayes, you're looking at very gifted head coaches. There is such a thing as a superstar head coach, but the superstar head coaches, that is also an overblown thing. That when we distribute power more, which I think personally an organisation like the FA have done very well, that somebody like Gareth Southgate is where he is and has had the results that he's had because he's been willing to distribute power more and listen to the people by his side. I think that that is where the future lies. whilst accepting there are very gifted head coaches who have a wonderful eye for tactics, who can persuade and influence, who have that kind of persona and charisma and character, but also understanding they also have to have the capacity to go, you know, I mean, Lee Richardson, Liverpool, and the guy at Manchester City, whose name escapes me,
they've David got sports.
Yes, David Young. Thank you. Well,
He was my site.
What the hell? Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I don't know what David does. What he does.
Yeah, so you lend on. So I was literally, it was on the tip of my tongue to talk about as soon as you mentioned Pep, because I spoke to David, and just after he got the role, a few months into getting the role, and I asked him what was it like, and my opinion is, and it kind of lends back to this study of Aaron Walsh, is of that people know it's good for them. Like, there's many coaches out there, they know this is the right thing to do, but actually, and this is the same for athletes, actually taking the step and engaging in the work is a completely different skill set and mindset as well. And Dave was talking about at Man City how he had tried something and it didn't work. It didn't work, but Pep said, okay, go again. And the openness, he just spoke of like the openness of the character to go, okay, rather than dismiss and move him to one side, completely open up to, okay, that's the same way a tactic in a game wouldn't work, or you just missed in a game, right? It's the same. It's not the case of, it's an understanding that not everything is going to work 100% of the time, but if you keep trying, that you're going to get there. And then I actually had a conversation with I can't remember the league of this team, I'm not going to name them, but it was a trainee psychologist in the academy of this squad, and they'd just brought in a new manager. The senior squad had got promoted, but the first day this new manager walked in, he walked straight into the changing room and kicked the psychologist out. Now, they got promoted. They got promoted because they purely focused on football. Now, having been an athlete and been in changing room, I only looked at that and went, okay, you've gone for quite literally short-term gain and the long-term pain is going to be there. These players, we go all the way back to our Aston Martin conversation around the human being. I just looked at that and go, where there is no player care there going to be going on. This is a manager that's completely gone numbers, performance, this is what matters, but there is a cost that will come with that eventually. I have no doubt. I've seen it, and it irked me so much. And I just looked at it and went, you have got Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, all of these top managers that you've just spoken about. Not only that, followed by camera crew after camera crew, leaving clues for every manager that ever wants to get into the game of like, how do I become good? And I think, again, I put it from an athlete's point of view. If I'm a young athlete right now trying to figure out who do I want to emulate, how do I want to be, I would be all over these people's Netflix documentaries, writing notes, like, how do they act? How do they talk? What sort of things are they doing outside of the skill sets that essentially you're doing on the day, to realize that's a model that clearly works, that's a way to be, and this is something I should potentially be engaging with,
yep,
rather than completely dismissive. And again, it goes back to that. I know what I need to do. I know it's good for me. But doing it, that's where the tough part lies.
Well said. Yeah, absolutely. And then, yeah, who's to blame here? I mean, is it that head coach, that manager? Well, maybe. Maybe short-sightedness or narrow-mindedness. But I completely agree with you. It's a short-term game. But what cost in the long term? What cost to the environment, the club environment? So, you know, I would actually, I feel, again, in line with what we're both saying, we're stepping into a world where more and more the type of club model, maybe across all sports, will be more in line with what, you know, I suppose the obvious models right now will be Brighton and Brentford. And it's easy to point to them because they've been successful as well. They've done multiple things very, very well. But they seem, at least from the outside in, to take care of their people from putting the palms in place. You know, there's that. And I think those organization-driven models that cares about the sport, cares about its people, cares about the community, are going to be the clubs that you know push through in the mid to long term. And obviously the clubs who have the money as well, they do that plus the money, arguably like a Manchester City, like a Liverpool, you know, they've got all the jigsaw puzzle filled in, you know, and so, yeah, it makes sense to me.
I mean, Brighton and Brentford are a very interesting one because the two owners both know each other and they're actually competitors. But they have very similar models. And the Brighton model, I'm a Brighton fan, and the Brighton model is very impressive. It's I don't think you would have found a team financially to have return on investment on some of its players. But actually, if you look at the way, if you step back and look at what they've been doing locally and the way in which they've got to that stage, it's not been a very quick fix. It's not Tony Bloom is not someone who just landed and instantly threw in a ton of money. He has incrementally done it through a structural process, and that's a very top-down approach that has been a very strong approach, and it's bled into the culture and created this very impressive team, and that brings in people like De Zerbi, who then only fuel that fire with the passion and the way in which he does things. And yeah, being a local, the feeling of Brighton Football Club has gone from being one of dreariness in the Withdean Stadium to now people are proud to be a fan of that club.
Well, can I just say, just quickly before you ask your next question, is it's just when you look at two things that they absolutely do is that from a top-down macro structure perspective, it's one, we're going to be data-driven because, you know, that's you know, that the ability to look at objective data is really, really important. So who we bring in and how we play, how we go about our analysis, data-driven. And we're going to treat our people like human beings. So we're going to have a well-being, wellness and welfare department and sports psychology department, if you want to call it that as well, you know, with James Bell down there, or at least he was down there. So, you know, I think there's, you know, when you've got that in place, that combination, there's more to it, of course. That's quite a powerful combination that we are going to treat people well, give them opportunities to grow, as well as have the capacity mathematically to, you know, observe the data, and it not just being intuition. You know, intuition has to be based, is by and large, is based on pattern recognition. So let's just break down what we see, the patterns we see. Let's think about where our gut feeling comes from. What does the data say? I'm talking way over my head because I'm definitely not a data analyst, mate. I'm not particularly adept at that stuff. But even I would say, if you don't have that in place, if you're not making intelligent decisions, and at that, we're venturing into a world where in sport, coaches who have a rich background in their sport have to be more open-minded. They can't get stuck in that identity of, oh, that person, he's a great football person. Great football person. Oh, yeah, that person's got golf. His dad was a golf coach. His great grandfather was a golf coach, PGA golf coach. He knows all about golf. Yeah, you can't question him on that one. But we've got to be open-minded enough to listen to people who come from the outside and have great ideas and have different lenses that we can go, okay, yeah, that benefits us here.
Yeah. I spoke to a fairly big sport agency, and they were changing a little bit of their tack. This is just purely from a which sort of players they start to work with. And it was based on, they had, because obviously working with an agent might scout a player just on performance, but also on a bit of feel. They have to have a bit of a look in the future as to what a player might achieve and the potential of a player. But this agency were really moneyballing the whole thing. They were hiring an analytics side the same way. Don't really want to dive into the industry, but the betting industry really looks at that side as well. But they were really looking at the analytics of what that player had produced, not just on goals scored in football, for example, tries or whatever. It was a lot of real depth of the data, and that was driving their decision making. Look, I'm very conscious of time for you, so I do want to get onto this topic that I wanted to discuss, which is you obviously have so many different people on your podcast. It is by far the best sports psychology podcast out there. And I am curious as to the amount of people that will listen to that show will not only be practitioners themselves there, but also probably future practitioners that are willing, learning, studying, getting in. I've seen you've had people that are studying come onto the show. And so I am around people that are studying in that area. And some of the worries and apprehensions I think people have are, what is it that makes a good practitioner in the psychology space? And I think you're perfectly positioned to kind of, I guess, provide a bit of an anatomy of what you believe, in your own opinion, would be a good psychological practitioner, whether that's in sports psychology, performance psychology, whichever way you want to frame that.
I think there's so many directions I could go. This is just my opinion. You know, I've sat in rooms with some very, very experienced sports psychs who have perhaps seen it slightly different to me. But so I'm certainly no oracle. But one of the reasons why I've directed the sports psych show, which is the podcast, and down a path it's gone, which is very much speaking to academics about their papers, more so than, you know, any other population, is because I think that we need a profession that, I think the academic work out there is really, really good. I think there's some great stuff that doesn't see the light of day. I suppose I'm thinking about this more for coaches. I'll come on to a practitioner. So I'm passionate about demystifying sports psychology or the biopsychosocial. When I say sports psychology, I actually believe that we need to be more robust in sports psychology, or as sports psychologists, we need to see our contribution to so many different areas and understand that whilst we might want to stay in our lane, we can still contribute to other lanes. So when I go into a gym, I was in the final gym the other week with the heads of performance. They've got two heads of performance. So I was saying, this is a psychological playground to me. You know, whether you're working on the basics of player concentration, confidence, control, commitment, if you want to use all the C's, cohesion even, you're working on that in here. You can work on imagery in here. You can work on so many different things in here in the gym. This is a psychological trip. Now, I'm not changing lanes to being a strength and conditioning coach or sports psychologist.
No, yeah, yeah.
But I'm from my lane, I'm going, hey, this is how we can work cohesively together. So I'm trying to help people understand the robust nature of sports psychology, how it's contributed to skill acquisition, how it's contributed to coaching science, how it contributes to other areas. And I want to demystify these academic papers so everybody becomes passionate about them. Now, coming on to the specifics of your questions with sports psychology practitioners, there's an element in my answer there that's relevant to your question, because I do believe that as practitioners, we do need to try to be as evidence-informed as possible, because I think that's what stands us apart. We don't just accept any old BS that's said, and I think we have to hold a constant critical eye to what's being presented to us, what we're reading, and obviously cast a critical eye on our own practice. That's just good practice, efficacious practice. But we also still need to appreciate the language of the sports, the context that we're walking into. Almost comes back to meeting people where they're at. And so I need to be robust enough to be able to take some of that academic work and be able to simplify it without, and bring it to life without destroying its essence, but be able to introduce it into a team or with a player or a group of players or an organization. And I think some of beats, which I love, you know, some approaches which I really love, I just couldn't take into certain teams or clubs or into certain coaches. I have to find a way to present it and deliver it in as effective a manner as I can, given who's in front of me. So I think at the heart, for me personally, at the heart of sports psychology, being a sports psychologist, is good deep knowledge around your theories, etc. However, having the skills to be able to demystify them and deliver them, being able to communicate them, I think that's absolutely imperative. And I think that maybe sometimes, if I think back to my master's program, it was just, well, we're just going to deliver you the theories. And you can argue that supervision should be maybe about, you know, being able to use psychological frameworks. But I just think that we need practitioners who are able to speak the language of the people who are in front of them to put this stuff across in as effective a way as possible. And of course, there's all other kinds of things. The ability to walk into an organization, you've got to know your stuff. You've got to know how to deliver it. And you've got to be able to go in there and deliver it confidently. And be able to put a program in place for the people that you're working with. Does that kind of answer your question?
It was beautifully said, actually. I think you've hit where I personally, if I put my athlete head on,
yes,
it's exactly what you want to hear. It's exactly what you want to hear, that this person knows what they're talking about, but also going to meet me where they're at and communicate in a way where I understand it. And that's it. That's all you, after that, it's relational. You're building relationship with these people.
I think, can I just come back at you there and say, when you say that's it, this is the thing.
Sorry.
No. It's a good thing to say, because you're right. That's it. But it's difficult to do.
Yeah, I didn't want to downplay it.
Downplaying
it. I'm just trying to, again, simplify it.
Yeah, but you're right. It's not. I'm not being critical of what you said. I just want to build on what you've said, is that is it, but it is hard. I think there's a but, because, and I'm guilty of this, because I think there's like a force within the profession that is all got to be evidence informed, got to be take from your theories and blah, blah, blah. And there's everything about, and maybe the sports show is a bit guilty of this, is everything's about, you know, we want to be theoretically underpinned, we want to have a theoretical orientation, you know, so we can organize ourselves, which is, as practitioners, which I absolutely agree with. But that puts us in a world where we are of complexity and complication, where we use difficult terms. I'm a big Yuri Hannan fan. Individual zones of optimal functioning. I love that stuff. You know, individual zones of optimal function, multi-state theory, all the stuff going on there. I think it's brilliant. I haven't had an opportunity in an organization to introduce that in its purest thought form. Hence why I ramble on about having a game face and having a match script and things like this, and trying to break it down for people. I think you've got to simplify it again. And that's hard to do, is to go into your lessons, learn about these theories, understand that you need to be theoretically underpinned, understand that you need a theoretical orientation towards excellence in your field if you're going to be consistent, but be able to draw on that, but deliver it in a manner that people understand. And you could argue that athletes have a language and coaches have a language. The coaches can be more complicated and complex, can deal with that, and athletes less so, although some athletes can. So, you know, that's a challenging landscape. But you've got to remember how simplified you have to make it. And even I forget often how simplified you have to make it.
Do you think that imposter syndrome plays a role in making it complicated in order to make someone feel adequate in that field?
Oh man, I just think it's a whole host. Yes, I think it's a whole host of factors. If I was to be critical on myself, I would say at times when I've been challenged, I've got defensive and I've started to use long words, you know, and it's just like, oh, Dan, shut up. I think there's so many things. Historically, you're trying to find your way in the organization, so you try to stand out. You know, that can be something. You're trying to show your value, so you know you use terms that others don't understand. You're trying to, you know, in the battle and you know the Wild West out there in terms of different practitioners and how they've been educated. Some people who are BPS or HCPC or whatever might, you know, start getting use pompous terms because, you know, they're trying to set themselves apart from the person who's done a 2-week NLP course, rightly or wrongly. So I think there's so many reasons why. I think to be effective, you have to simplify. And I find it really, really difficult. I don't think it's easy. I don't think it's easy.
I mean, you're surrounding yourself with academics every week, so you are in teams, you are around them. So, God, you've got it on your shoulders there.
It's well said. And similarly, I would say, and I said this in a recording, it's not out yet, but speaking with Professor Mark Williams and Professor Nikki Hodges on a Skill Act thing I was recording recently, and we were talking about coaching being tough. And I found myself saying, you know, I think one of the challenges, not enough coaches think that coaching is really tough. It's as tough a hobby or profession as you can actually pick. And I think if more coaches saw it that way, that they'd be willing to engage more with the terms that we use, that they'd be willing to engage more with uncertainty and not always thinking that they have to have an answer. You know, it's hard. I don't have an answer for everything, especially in psychology. And I don't have an answer maybe for some of the things you're asking me. And that's okay. I think uncertainty should be allowed. And I think that, you know, if we embrace that uncertainty, then maybe we'll get a little bit better as a consequence.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very conscious of time, and I think that was a great place where we can wrap it up for this episode. I have a million and one things that I would still want to continue talking to you, but I don't want to eat into your time. Dan, thank you so much for that. I think those are actually really important answers and questions to throw around this space. I think listening to your show, they're just natural questions that I have when I'm listening to the very academic side of this. And I think where the rubber hits the road is very, very important for people to understand. And you do a great job with the show. Please don't stop. So that's from someone who listens. But is there anything at the moment that you're curious about in the field that you're developing? Just before we go, is there something that really flicks your switches at the moment?
I'd say most of my work is in football, and I just, but you could apply this to, you know, cricket in the nets or, I suppose, golf on the practice ground, tennis on the training course, is that, you know, just the continued application of sports psychology or biopsychosocial frameworks, tools, techniques, approaches, etc., within training, you know, within practice sessions. That I think we continue to need to have conversations around what that looks like. That so much of what we do can take place in that hour and a half training or half a day's golf practice or whatever. That I think that, again, taking a broad definition of sports psychology with its fingers in skill acquisition and its foot placed within coaching science and so on and so forth. That, as sports psychologists, we need to continue to make sure that we are helping coaches understand that not all, but a lot of what we, let's be clear, not all, but a lot of what we do can be done in, we can help coaches do it in training, and we can help organizations at a systemic level with those macro structures and those meso systems, that it's not just one-to-ones, small group stuff, that it, that it's, that we can help with a broader in a broader population across the, all these organizations. I think that's absolutely crucial as well. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in, what is a real, if you take, think football, what does an hour of training look like with loads of psychosocial stuff thrown into the mix, complementing and constantly interacting with the technical, tactical, physical sides of things with each key stakeholder involved, you know, with assistant coaches. Again, I suppose I'm talking about clubs here with the luxury of coaching staff. I'm thinking of, you know, when I've stood by the side of Premier League pitches, how big can we make those sessions from a psychosocial perspective, you know, coaching staff involved in promoting values, leadership, teamwork, relationship, behaviours, managing emotions, creating consequences, effective learning from a cognitive perspective. There's so many mini things that can be done. And I just have a vision of just this amazing hour, hour and a half of the integration of biopsychosocial and technical, tactical, physical, and it just being outstanding. You know, we all were using water breaks for to test and check for understanding. So players are learning better. There's memory consolidation, things like that, where we're trying to help this information go into long-term memory. There's all kinds of things that can be done. That's what really, really excites me, alongside that, if we go up to that macro structure, well, can we really help there as well, with things like psychologically informed environments and motivational climates, and role clarity and things like that. Yeah, I think there's so much to be done, and those are the kind of things that really interest me.
Love it, mate. I mean, again, we could go on for hours, and maybe I'll have to get you back for your hat trick coming on the show. But Dan, all links will be in the show notes for getting onto the Sports Psych Show and to connect with you. But thank you once again for your time. I really appreciate it, mate.
Thanks, Lewis. Thank you, mate.